Thank you for tuning in to the Essential Church Podcast, a church where we focus on restoration over denomination. If you're in the Virginia Beach area and would like to find out more about Essential Church, visit our webpage at essentialchurch.com.
It's a Wizard electronic organizer for my dad. I'm going to Florida for his birthday.
How much was it?
$200, but I'll tell him it's $50. He doesn't care about the gift. He gets excited about the deal.
Why are you getting a Wizard for $50?
Tell him I got it on the street and maybe it's hot. That's his favorite.
Ooh! It's a radar detector.
Radar detector? I've never seen you go over 20 miles an hour. You're like the Grand Marshal of the Rose Bowl Parade. It's a Wizard organizer.
This looks like too much money.
Nah, I got it from a guy on the street. It was like $50.
You think it's hot?
Could be.
Hello, boy! Helen, Jerry got me a hot Wizard computer.
I'm right here.
You can do everything with it. You can get email, fax, as a calculator.
So I can use it in the restaurant to figure out the tip?
Yeah, I guess. But the really cool thing is the daily planner.
Helen, we can go to the restaurants and figure out the tips.
Jerry, you're getting your father too excited.
Now for my Wizard tip calculator.
Dad, it's got lots of other functions.
Don't worry, I'll get to the other functions. How does a 12.4% sound?
Well, your tip is $4.36.6666.
We'll round down.
Dad, I'm sorry.
You should be. How could you spend $200 on a tip calculator?
It does other things!
Had a Christmas where you felt like Seinfeld and his dad. I don't know whether it's giving tech gifts to your parents or to your kids, or maybe it's your kids asking for stuff and you have no idea what it does, and so you're like, well, what is this thing you want me to get you? It's just tech kind of always befuddles a lot of us, and the problem with something like that is if they don't know what it does, they really don't know how to be appreciative of it. Like, you ever have those moments where it's like, oh, thanks, it's a what is it? What's it do? And so Morty's problem, of course, with the Wizard. Now, the Wizard is like the precursor of the Palm, which is the precursor of the BlackBerry, which is the precursor of the iPhone. And so back in the day, that was kind of like the newest, coolest gadget. And so all he thinks it does, of course, is a tip calculator. And Jerry's like, it does more things. And if you could realize how much more it does, you would like it a lot more. You'd get a lot more out of it. You'd be a lot more appreciative of it. You'd really enjoy the gift a whole lot more. And if you don't really know everything you got sitting in your hand, then you're really not going to be able to enjoy it or get the most out of it. And I think that's pretty much true when it comes to Christmas. We kind of left off last week with sort of this one thought that instead of beginning the Christmas season asking the question, what is it that I want this Christmas? Maybe we could begin the Christmas season by simply asking, what is it that I have because of Christmas? And for some of you, you might have said, yeah, that sounds like a great idea. What do we have? Like, what it do? What do we get here? What does all this do? And so I think a lot of us, we come to Christmas, and we kind of pretty much go, I got a tip calculator out of Christmas, but I'm not really sure what else. It's kind of like, I got salvation, okay? That means I've got the fire insurance. I don't have to spend eternity in hell. So that means I can be saved from sins. pretty much as anything else. And it's like a lot of people, that's their whole definition of what it means to be a Christian, is that you don't go to hell. And it's so much more. That was just sort of a means to the end. It's just sort of like one of those ancillary type of things. It's sort of like one of those extra pieces there with it. It's all about, really, about this relationship with God. That is what the centerpiece of Christmas is all about. And so when you read in the Christmas stories, you begin off the Christmas story in the book of Matthew. He says there's this thing that God's been telling us for 700 years he was going to do, and here it is, it's finally come. It says in Matthew chapter 1, verse 22 and 3, it says, "And all this took place to fulfill what the Lord had said through the prophet Isaiah 700 years before, that the virgin will conceive and give birth to a son, and they will call him Emmanuel, which means God with us." You know, to really understand or appreciate a gift, sometimes you need to know more about what it does. We'll get to that in a minute. But sometimes, to really know what it does, you kind of need to get a little bit of backstory on, a little bit of background, a little bit of history on it. For instance, sometimes you maybe give a gift to a kid nowadays, and they just really don't really appreciate what it is they've been given. Or maybe they're so spoiled in the technological age in which they live, they don't realize what it was like back in the day. Like, they get an iPad that has 16 gigs of memory on it, and they look at it and just go, 16, that's it? Okay. I mean, like, you're wanting to not get violent in this moment, and all you can think of is, my first computer that our family shared had 128K. 128K. That was it. The IBM PC, 128K. There is more computing power in your calculator than there was in that whole computer, and that got us through. I went to college with a typewriter. I'm old enough to have brought a freaking typewriter with me to college. I didn't have a computer till after college. I'm that old, right? I mean, seriously, I'm just right there at the cusp of being able to identify with a lot of older folks in this room because I went to college with a typewriter. My first computer had 1.6 gigabytes, which I thought was, whoa! I think watches can now come with more memory than that computer came nowadays. And so you kind of have a little bit of history to really understand what it is that you now have. Or maybe you give your kid, like, what kid doesn't want a bike? And so you give them a bike, and they're like, where's the motor? What, you think I'm going to, like, pedal on this thing? Seriously? Do you know how much work that's going to take? Come on, after all day playing video games, you want me to go out and exercise on this thing? No, I need a motor. Scooter, hoverboard, golf cart, car, something with a motor. Because, I mean, you're not gonna really going to ask me, Dad, to, like, pedal this thing, right, like you did back in the day. Yeah, what would be so bad about that? Bike for Christmas, my goodness. I remember even somebody says, oh, do you want a bike for Christmas? I just kid go, I want a scooter. It's just like, what has this world come to? My gosh. So kind of a little bit of back in the day story on this whole God with us thing. Let's go all the way back to the very beginning. The very beginning, there was God with us in the same way that is being foretold that's going to come with Jesus. It was God with us. That was Adam and Eve. They were there in the garden walking with God in the cool of the day. And of course, you know what messed all of that whole thing up was sin. Sin enters in, and hiding begins. And the separation begins, and they're banished from the garden, and they can't just, you know, walk in and out of God's presence like they did when they were there in the garden. And even when God appears, it's always sort of with a veiled separation from this point forward. It's by a pillar of cloud by day or fire by night. It's there in the throne room of where the Ark of the Covenant is, back behind the Holy of Holies, where one priest could enter into the presence once a year. Now, there's always this distance from this point on between people and God. And sometimes because of people's repeated sin and continued disobedience, the separation becomes permanent, like with Cain. So Adam and Eve, they get banished from the garden, and so there's this level of separation between them and God, but God is still communicating with them. And then after Cain has some jealousy towards his brother Abel, God comes to him. He says, listen, sin is crouching at your door. It's desire to have you. You must subdue it. And instead, Cain goes ahead and gives in to that prideful thought and that envious thought, and he kills his brother. And at this point, God comes to him and says, you know, you're banished. And so it says, now Cain went out from the Lord's presence and lived in the land of Nod. That's a place of wandering. And that was his existence from that point forward. He was out of God's presence. And you see this phrase come up again and again and again in the Old Testament. Whenever somebody has repeated deliberate disobedience over and over and over again, defying against God and rebelling against God, at some point God would say, okay, be gone then. It happened with Saul. Saul continued to disobey God again and again and again. And after his final time, it says, the Spirit of the Lord had departed Saul, and he was tormented over it. And he looks to Samuel, and he says, well, Samuel, let's at least go out and make a good show for the people. And Samuel says, that's all you want? Fine. And never again did Samuel ever come into his presence because God wasn't in his presence. You see the same thing in the life of Samson, where Samson, after repeated and repeated deliberate disobedience from God, he's there with Delilah, and again and again and again, he begins to tempt and tempt and tempt and tempt fate. And then finally, she says to him, Samson, the Philistines are upon you. And so Samson gets up as he always did before, but it says, but he did not realize that the Spirit of the Lord had departed. And so there he was in his own strength, going into battle without God. And he gets his eyes gouged out, and he gets bound by chains, and he gets let off. The whole people as an entire nation experienced this in Ezekiel chapter 10, that the whole people as an entire nation, after deliberate, repeated disobedience, had gotten so bad, finally it says that the glory of the Lord rose up and departed the temple. Whereas it always hovered there in the Holy of Holies above the Ark of the Covenant in that holy place, and eventually God just says, you know, I'm out. I'm out. And so up and it goes. And so when God comes and he says that this is God with us, see, that means something to them back then in that time because they knew what it was like and they'd experienced the stories of God just up and leaving and finally saying, that's it, I've had enough, I can't go here anymore. It almost happened with the Israelites when they were in the middle of the wilderness, when Moses leads them out of Egypt, they're out there in the wilderness and he's gone up onto the mountain to receive the Ten Commandments from God, and he comes down and what does he find? He finds that people have made a golden calf, and they begin to worship this golden calf and thank and praise this golden calf for providing all this stuff for them. And God has finally had enough with the people. I mean, after all he's done to get them out of Egypt, what do? They get in the wilderness and they complain because there's no water, and God provides water. They complain because they don't have the kind of food they want, and God provides the manna from heaven. And they say, you know, it'd be better if we just went back to Egypt. And God's like, are you kidding me? And so God gives them Ten Commandments, or ways to live by, how they could have a peaceful and great society. And what do? They immediately begin to look to a calf, a golden calf that they make out of the golden image, and they say, this is our God. This is who we're going to worship. And God says, you know, I'm done. I'll give you the promised land. Moses, you take the people to the promised land, but I'm not going with you. And you see in Exodus chapter 33, it says, to go on up, but I will not go with you because you are a stiff-necked people. And in that moment, Moses has a choice. He's got a choice to make. He's like, okay, let me get this straight. I get all the blessings, all the goodies, all the presents if I go, but you're not going to go with me. And it's that age-old question, what would you rather have? Would you rather have somebody's presence or would you rather have the presence? And Moses has to choose. And he looks to God and he says, you know, if you're not going with us, I don't want to go. I don't want to go. I don't want to go if you're not going to be with us. And you kind of have to understand a little bit about Moses' background up to this point. Moses had already spent a lot of time out in the wilderness apart from everybody that he knew and loved. And he's out there tending sheep. And he's in this very same place right here at Mount Sinai where he's at right now. And he's out there and he sees a bush that is burning but is not consumed. And he comes close and he hears a voice from God saying to remove your sandals, for the place in which you are standing is holy ground. It's the same mountain where he gets the Ten Commandments, and he's right back in the same place, and that led him on a journey where God calls him, and he says, I want you to go to the most powerful man on the face of the earth right now, which is Pharaoh. He's the world's superpower. If you ever studied world history in school, you studied about the pharaohs and about Egypt and about their power and their might and their military. I want you to go to them. I want you to look them straight in the face and say, I'm going to take a little over 1 million people of your slave labor force along with me, and by the way, you're going to pay us as we leave town. And he's like, seriously, who am I that I'm going to go to Pharaoh? What is it I'm going to say? And in Exodus chapter 3, it says, and God says to him, Moses, I will be with you. I will be with you. Is that enough? Is that enough for you to know that I will be with you? And so he does, and he takes God up on the dare, and he goes into Pharaoh, and he says, I'm taking the people with me. And Pharaoh says, over my dead body. And so 10 plagues fall upon Egypt, and the last one takes Pharaoh's son, and he finally says, okay, you can go. And so Moses goes out from Pharaoh's presence, and they leave as a conquering army. They're given all kinds of gold and precious silver and jewels as they leave town, like a conquering army would lead. And they get out, and it's this amazing time, but then they get out to the Red Sea, and Pharaoh's army comes after them. And what now? What now? And Moses simply just relies, and he says, all right, God, you said you'd be with me. I need you to be with me in this moment. So watch and see, because you're going to see something's going to blow your socks off. And sure enough, God just splits the sea in half, and they walk through it on dry ground. When they get to the other side and the people begin to complain they don't have anything to drink, he strikes a rock and water comes out. And when they complain there's no food, they wake up and there's manna on the ground. Moses knows what it's like to be with God. It's provision, it's protection. Maybe some of you had that experience with somebody in your life. I had certain times in my life where just because I was with somebody, I had a sense of security or peace about life or what was going to happen. It really didn't matter. I remember when I had a golfing buddy when I was in college. His name's Jamie Brown. And we met at the same golf course like for several weeks in a row. We ended up playing together a lot, and so we just kind of became good friends. Now, what you got to know about Jamie is you may not like him because he was Michael Irvin's cousin, but you may like him since he went on to play for the Redskins. See, when he played for the Denver Broncos, and he played for the Redskins and one other team. Jamie was a starting left tackle at Florida A&M. He was 6'8", 320 pounds. Okay? Big dude, to say the least. And we're out playing golf together after several times playing together, and I hit a drive. We were waiting for this group in front of us. Was kind of slow, so I hit a drive, and it accidentally went farther than I thought it would go, and it kind of rolled up into them. And if you've ever played golf before, this is kind of a big faux pas. Well, this was a kind of a golf course where you could drink beer while you're playing, and so they were a little rowdy, and so they turned their golf carts around like they were going to come after us. And I'm like, uh-oh, and Jamie goes, what are they going to do to us? I'm like, oh, yeah, us. Yeah, what are they going to do to us? Come on, you want another one? And so I'm sitting there talking trash. Why? Because I got Jamie Brown with me. By myself, I might get in my cart and leave. But I got 6'8", 320-pound NFL. You know, he's about to get drafted into the NFL right now. What you going to do to us? Us, that is. I had that same sense of confidence once when I played soccer. You know, when you play in the same rec league year after year after year, you kind of know all the kids, right? And so I remember showing up for practice the very first day where you're kind of sizing up your team, and I'm looking around. I just come off of one of the worst teams in the league the year before, and so I get to this team. I'm thinking, come on, let this be a good year. And I look around, and it's the same old sorry kids, and I'm thinking, okay, we're done. We don't have a shot. And so I come home from practice that first day. Mom's like, what's wrong? I was like, it's just going to be another long, bad year. And so she's like, well, you know, we have a rule in our family, you know, once we sign up for something, we don't quit. I'm like, yeah, I know. So I go to practice the second day, and Jay Mallow's there. That doesn't mean anything to any of y'all, but if you were in Palm Beach County and Jay Mallow showed up on your team, you're like, championship, because I'd already won a championship once, and it was when he was on my team. His team wins it every year because, you know, there's always that one kid in rec league who's like five grade levels, age levels better than everybody else. That was Jay. And so I come home from the second day of practice, and Mom's like, your mood sure changed. You know, what happened? I said, Jay showed up. And she goes, Mallow? I said, yeah. She goes, so what do you think? I'm like, oh, we're going to win. We're going to win. No doubt, we're going to win. And we did. And later on, when I was in high school, the number 2, 3, 4 leading scorers were on my team in my high school, plus the number 1 goalie for the most shutouts in the county was on my team. We lost in the finals. Guess to who? Jay Mallow. He was the only kid on that other team. Even in freaking high school, as seniors in high school, he was still that good. He was like freaking Pele among us. And if he was on your team, you knew you had victory. The victory is already assured. You already knew you were going to win the championship. You were already just dusting off a place on the shelf where your trophy was going to go. Why? Because when you were in his presence and he was on your team, you didn't have to worry about the outcome of the game. He was going to come through for you. And it was just like that. There's been people like that over time. I remember another time I was in high school. I went to high school with Mike Nicholas. You know, yes, he is that Nicholas of the Nicholas family. It's funny, I was typing his name in my notes, and of course it spell checks. You know, how about having a last name that spell checks for you? Why? Because if your dad's the greatest golfer of all time, yes, he is, and nobody else is. He still has the most championships, the most majors. He is the greatest golfer of all time. So I went to high school with him, and actually his dad kind of founded the school. And so there was different times where we'd be in a place we shouldn't be at school, and so we'd be like, hey, you guys are going to get in trouble. And we're like, no, we're with Mike. What do you say to that? There's another time we were at the first year that Jack was on the seniors tour. And of course, he won everything because he beat all those people all his, you know, younger life. And so he beats them all when he gets older. And so he's at the PGA Championship. We're at it with Mike. And of course, his dad's winning the thing. And we had access to anywhere we wanted to go on the course. It was like, hey, you kids. And then Mike's like, I'm sorry, Mr. Nicholas. We're with Mr. Nicholas. He's 18 years old. He's one of our friends, right? We could go anywhere. He gave us access and acceptance anywhere we wanted to go. And you see, when you're with certain people, you have protection, you have victory that's guaranteed, you have access, you have acceptance. And when you're with those kind of people, you realize, you know, there's something special just because you're with them, and you wouldn't have those things if you weren't with them. And so when Moses looks at the prospect of going somewhere without God, he's like, no, mm-mm. You're the thing that makes it all worthwhile, and you're the thing that comes through when things don't go well. And I don't want to go if you're not going to go with me. And this is a lesson that the great men and women of the Bible and the Old Testament learned over and over and over again. You see the story of Joseph, that Joseph, he lived a very difficult life. His brothers betrayed him, sold him as a slave. He ends up in a foreign country. He gets there, he's making the best of a bad situation, and he just has a sense that God is with him even in the midst of a bad situation. And so the text says again and again and again, and the Lord was with Joseph. And then, of course, there's this whole thing where he gets falsely accused of sexual misconduct and kind of like just something you'd see in today's paper, and he gets thrown in jail for it. And he spends 12 years in jail for something he didn't do. And finally, it's like there's this ray of hope that this guy might be able to help get him out. And so he does this guy a favor and says, hey, can you do me a solid back? And the guy's like, sure, no problem. This other guy gets out and completely forgets about him for another 2 years. But it says, hey, don't worry about that because the Lord was with Joseph. And some of you are looking at this going, if this is what it means to have God with me, it doesn't seem like it's all that good of a thing. But you know, you see, Joseph just understood, if God is with me, there's something good's going to happen. It's going to turn out for the best. I got Jay Mallow on my team. I got Jamie Brown standing right next to me. I got Mike Nicholas in my crew. It's going to be okay. And eventually it was okay. And eventually Joseph is exalted to the second highest position in all the earth as Pharaoh's right-hand man. You see, the same kind of thing happens in the story of Joshua. Joshua is the one who succeeds Moses after Moses passes away. It's up to Joshua to literally fight an uphill battle his whole life. And that's what Joshua does for the rest of his life. He fights an uphill battle. He goes into the promised land, and he's taking on these cities. And these cities are well fortified, and many of them are up at the top of hills. Why? Because if you're going to build a city and want to be fortified, where's the best place to build a fortified city? On the top of a hill. What's the most difficult kind of battle to win? We all even say it. An uphill battle, which is what Joshua did again and again and again. And he's looking at God saying, how on earth am I going to fight an uphill battle with an unskilled, untrained army against these fortified great cities of these people who are giants? We look like grasshoppers in our eyes. How are we going to do that? And God simply says this. He says, in the same way that I was with Moses, so I will be with you. I will never leave you nor forsake you. So be strong and be courageous, because you will lead this people to inherit the land that I swore to give to them. So be strong and be very courageous. So just obey everything that Moses, my servant, gave you. Don't turn from the left or to the right. You might be successful wherever you go. Keep this book of the law always on your lips. Meditate on it day and night. So you might be careful to do everything that is written in it. Then you'll be prosperous and successful. So have I not commanded you to be strong and courageous? Do not be afraid. Do not be discouraged. For the Lord your God will be with you wherever you go. And he leads them out into battle with all kinds of crazy battle plans. Just march around the city and I'll take care of the rest. He gets his people on the run. He's like, the sun's going to go down. Once they get into the hills, we're going to lose him. We're going to have to fight this battle all over again. God's like, no problem. I'll just make the sun stop for a little while. Because when God is with us, as it says in Romans, does it really matter what comes against us? It's Romans chapter 8, 31. If God is with us, does it matter who comes against us? Does it matter what comes against us? Does it matter really what the odds are? Does it matter really what the circumstance is? Does it really matter? If God is with us, it really doesn't matter what it is that we face. And you see this pattern again and again and again in the Old Testament. You see in the life of David, that David gets anointed from a young age that God is going to be with him. And Samuel pronounces this blessing over him, that God will be with you. And so David goes into his life and he, as a shepherd, he faces a lion and a bear, and he has no fear because God is with him. And then later on, when he hears that there's this giant of a warrior named Goliath who's defying the armies of Israel, he comes before Saul and he says, no big deal, God was with me with the lion and the bear. How's it going to be different with this guy? And he runs out into battle with just 5 stones, and he says, you come at me with a spear and a sword, but I come unto you in the name of the Lord, who I know is with me and is going to win this battle for me. And he does. But then, you know, David spends a lot of his life on the run from that very same king, Saul, who hates him and despises the fact that God has chosen him to be the next king, and so he wants his life. So he hides out in the caves, and he's always on the run, and he pens words like this out of Psalm 23. He says, even though I walk through the darkest valley, I fear no evil. Why? Why? You know the next line. Because you are with me. Because you are with me. See, when you know that God is with you, you don't fear the situation. You have a confidence about the outcome of the situation. You know that there's an acceptance that is going to be granted to you because of who is with you. That's why he says, surely your goodness and love will follow me all the days of my life, and I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever, because I have access to places I wouldn't have access if I wasn't with you. I think it's interesting that the Christmas story begins with this promise, and I wonder how much Joseph and Mary had to lean on this promise that God would be with them and they would find God as literally with them. I mean, think about the difficulties that they faced in this journey. They got to travel 100 miles down to Joseph's, you know, family heritage city. They've got no place to stay. You got to put the pieces together there. Why do they have no place to stay? Isn't it where his family's from? Shouldn't he have some family in town? Nobody wants a pregnant girl who's pregnant out of wedlock, really. Nobody's going to want to take you in. And in an inn where there's no separate rooms, everybody's in one big room. Anybody want a pregnant woman giving birth to a baby when everybody else is trying to sleep? No. No, thank you. No, thank you. No room at the inn. And so they end up in a manger in the very caves where the lambs were born that would often be sacrificed in the temple for atonements. And there Jesus is born. And they've got to be thinking to themselves, okay, this isn't easy, but we got to trust and confidence that God is with us. And then these men come from the east and say, you know, they bring these gifts, and these gifts are amazing. They're like, wow, God, you really are blessing us. But then they find out why it is that God has blessed them, because now the king of the land, this tyrant Herod, wants their life. And so they flee 450 miles to the west over to Egypt and run for their lives. Just imagine how fun that was. People always talk about Mary and Joseph on the donkey when she's, you know, great, you know, great with a child. What do you think it was like traveling 450 miles with a toddler? If you've ever taken a cross-country type of trip in a minivan with a toddler, imagine what it's like when you're not in a minivan. Imagine when you're only the same donkey or you got to walk holding that little sucker. That was a fun trip. I'm just saying. And then come back. Life, bottom line, wasn't easy. And all they had to go on was God's with us. And he's doing something in us. And there's something here because of what God is doing right now. And you see, from the time that Jesus came and came with us, never again would people have to experience a separation from God like they did in the Old Testament. See, that's just something you young kids here in the New Testament era just take for granted. You don't know what it was like back in the olden day. And so when Jesus came, it was God with us, and he was literally there among them, and his presence was there with them. And then when he dies on the cross, the temple that, or inside the temple where the robe, or the curtain that separated the people from the holiest place where God's presence was said to dwell, was torn from top to bottom, because never again would they ever be separated from God like they were in the past. And the very last thing that Jesus says as he departs the earth is what? And lo, I am with you always, even to the end of the age, it says in Matthew 28. And so there's a promise that God will be with us. And he'll be with us. Why? Because Jesus was forsaken for us. See, there on the cross, Jesus was separated from the Father God so that we would never have to be from this point forward. And so when you think about this Christmas and what it is that you experience, maybe you could begin to realize what it is you have at Christmas is this understanding that if God is for us, it really doesn't matter what comes against us. You know, a lot of life circumstances seem to come against us, and we begin to wonder and question God's goodness, his character, his plan, his wisdom, something that I'm sure all these characters at some point may have thought or wondered about. And all they had to rely on was this promise that God would be with them through it all. Paul would write from a prison cell, with the confidence that God is with him, he would say that we have a peace that passes all understanding. Some people could look at you and say, how on earth could you be calm right now with everything going on around you and everything falling apart around you? I don't know. I can't explain it. All I can tell you is that God is with us. How are you going to win a championship with that kind of team? All I can tell you is we got Jay Mallow. It doesn't matter. He's going to figure it out. What are you going to do if they want to come up and fight? I don't got to worry about what they're going to do if they come up and fight. I got Jamie Brown with me. It doesn't really matter. It doesn't matter because God is with us. And if I got God with me, it doesn't matter what the circumstances. It doesn't matter what comes against me. It doesn't matter. So this Christmas, my hope for you is that you could find a joy in the presence of God more than the presence around the tree. And like Moses said, you know, God, if you're not with me, it really doesn't matter what I get or don't get this Christmas. It doesn't really matter who is or who isn't with us this Christmas, as long as I have you. And every one of us has to come to the point in life where we look to God and say, God, your presence in my life is far better than anything this life could give us or anything that this life could take away from us. The same confidence that Job had when he said, the Lord has given, the Lord has taken away, but I will praise the name of the Lord because God is with me in this time. And so maybe this Christmas is something you want. Maybe there's this Christmas or somebody that you miss. My question is can God's presence this Christmas simply be enough for you? That this Christmas you could be Christmas, you could be confident, you could be at peace because God is with you. Let us pray. Father, that is a true challenge to cultivate such a deep-seated sense of confidence of your presence. That your presence is far greater than any gift under the tree or any person that we could be with. Because having all that stuff or any person, as Moses understood, doesn't matter if I don't have you. Because this life is all about a relationship with you that will last for all eternity. This Christmas, you've given us a foretaste of what eternity will be like. You've allowed us to live in your presence. And even better, you've allowed your presence to live within us. So, Father, may we appreciate and thank you for this gift and celebrate what we have in you this Christmas. And in Jesus' name, amen.
Thank you for listening to the Essential Church Podcast. Let me encourage you to pause for a moment and reflect on what you've heard. It's not the hearing of the word, but the application that makes all the difference.